Francis will be back tomorrow with this week's edition of Interval, his feature of out-of-print jazz recordings. In the meantime, if you'd like to write him, if you have any comments on some of the comments that he made, here's the address. It's Fresh Air, WUHY, Independence Mall West, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, 19106. It's about 4 minutes after 4 o'clock, and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. I keep inviting back to Fresh Air a rabbi and a reverend who both have a very fresh and very personal interpretation of their religions, and who are also good friends and they enjoy getting together and talking about religion. With me now is Reverend Ralph Moore, who is a priest in the Episcopal Church and director of the Christian Association on the Penn campus, and Rabbi Meir Seligman of Temple Shalom in Broomall, which is a Reformed temple. I want to talk today about some concepts that we find in many religions but are interpreted differently within each religion, and we'll be going into some concepts like salvation or enlightenment, afterlife, heaven and hell, the soul. Pretty heavy stuff. Okay, welcome back to Fresh Air, both of you. It's great to have you back again. A lot of the new religions and a lot of the people who have gotten into Eastern religions talk about things like enlightenment. And I think probably particularly people who have read about Buddhism or who have some new religion that's mildly based or modeled on Buddhism will talk about enlightenment. Does the term enlightenment have meaning for you?
Well, it does for me because I see things in a fairly universal way, which makes Christianity, for me, a specific springboard into an understanding of spirituality, which I think is universal. So insofar as the word literally means to see the light or to have illumination or to discover, that's the way I see to be the biblical understanding of one's spirituality, a growth process, an unfolding process, one always receiving the light. That's a concept which I think is given. It's dynamic. It's not a fossilized doctrine. It's a process.
It's not a state that you reach, like he has reached enlightenment.
No, I've never really taken it that far to where it's a state that one accomplishes.
It can be looked upon, I guess, as a particular plateau that one can arrive at, and the plateaus may change in the life process of an individual. Somehow or rather, there are different stages in your life when you feel a goodly portion of who you are is together. And maybe that's somehow a sense of enlightenment or a sense of inner peace or what I like to call integrity, a sense of being integrated within oneself and integrated into the cosmos. And then somewhere along the line in the life process, not because you've asked to have it happen, you slip off the plateau, and then you go through a kind of disintegrative period, and then somewhere along the line you reintegrate again. I think that in concept of enlightenment, though, may be different from what we would traditionally refer to as salvation within Judaism and Christianity, which really meant, in a developmental way, a life after death, a reuniting of one's soul and body when God establishes his kingdom on earth, so that the salvation is somewhere off in the future, as opposed to enlightenment being able to mean something that's here and now.
When some people talk about enlightenment, it's a sense of constant knowing and constant bliss, right? Now, I'm going to refer to bliss here. I've heard that concept referred to in two ways. Okay, one where it's this constant state of bliss and you're smiling all the time and laughing uncontrollably because life is wonderful. But another is where you recognize good and evil and feel both of their presences in the world and are pretty stable within that, and it's not constant joy. And a sense of what one does not look for constant joy because it's just not what it's about, that there's good and evil and they both have to be confronted.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that? Are you involved in some pursuit of bliss? Does religion to you become a path for blissfulness or for enlightenment as a sense of a more constant joy?
I'm pretty careful about that because I catch myself making bliss as some kind of objective toward which I'm striving. And that then makes it almost impossible for me to reach it. the idea of bliss being some kind of goal is not one that I feel comfortable with. I have experienced what might be called bliss in both of the definitions you just gave. Sense of having some connection with the stability of the universe, if you want to put it like that, which is so relaxing and so freeing, liberating. And then I've also felt ecstatic, which I prefer over bliss, a state of real sensual, sensuous, mental excitement, everything, physical and mental, which are usually moments of mountaintop or climactic experiences in with people or by myself. But in neither case have those been things that I've striven for. I've usually been really much more interested in knowing myself better, finding what it is that I am, what my skills are, and how I can function in some sense of harmony with the brothers and sisters in the human race, and work at the issues that have to do with producing good life and keeping people from destroying life and stuff like that. And in the midst of all that process, wow, there's a gift delivered from somewhere all of a sudden. It's bliss or joy or, you know, something like that. So I don't like putting the emphasis, you know, that's like the horse before the cart to some degree in my experience.
I personalize it and say that I've always had to decide in my mind whether I want truth or happiness. And I have usually come to the conclusion that I would much prefer having the truth and the pain attached to the truth than happiness. And that's the way I would translate the issue of being able to see good and evil in the world as opposed to seeing bliss. I think that there are, if I can say them, acts of grace or happenings of grace that occur in one's life's process, not because you set them as goals, as you said, Ralph, to go after them, but because they somehow or other come. And I remember, too, I really keyed in with what you said before. I remember in my own, one of the important changes that I had in my life, and I was rethinking my belief in God, my concept of who I was as a person, and my concept of who I wanted to be as a rabbi, that I was walking out of class one day after having studied Maimonides, a 13th century Jewish philosopher, doctor, legalist, and I just kind of got stopped short in the hallway. And I had a sense of being together with everything. It just like you, everything fit. And I wasn't there for a long time in the hallway or in that sense of having everything fit together. But I don't know what brought it about. I'm sure that I could analyze it into its component parts if I wanted. But it came out of a function of knowing and searching. Though it was like a synergistic effect. It wasn't something I had anticipated. It came. So I think that those special gifts come if the commitment that you have, that one has, is to search for how to know oneself and one's place with oneself and with others better.
Yeah. I can give you an example that happened to me just recently. I'll even quote some scripture. Okay, that'll make it interesting to somebody out there. Last Sunday was the first Sunday in the Christian season of Lent. This is Ash Wednesday was a week ago today. And I was asked to preach at St. Mary's Episcopal Church here on the Penn campus. And the text for the first Sunday in Lent is Jesus going into the wilderness to begin the famous 40 days of fasting, during which time he's tempted by the devil, who offers him all kinds of material and worldly and political and spiritual power. So usually it's my custom when I'm going to preach to noodle on it in my mind for 2 or 3 weeks prior. I kind of have these things kind of going in my head. The previous Sunday, a week ago from last Sunday, I was serving on the altar at St. Mary's Church during the Mass, and I was not the celebrant. Another priest was to my right. I was over here at the left end of the altar, and right during one of the most solemn moments, I looked down and a little bug was crawling all over the top of the altar. Well, I somehow fell into that. And with one ear, I was listening to all this sanctimonious language, lifting up the bread and the wine as offering to God and to hoping for transubstantiation and all the rest of these crazy things. And then here came this little live bug wandering all over the place. It would have just crushed me if anyone had wiped him away or something like that. Because suddenly I said to myself, as one particular phrase in the Mass came, seeking unity, constancy, and peace. And I thought to myself, here we human beings are struggling around with our symbols and our doctrines and so forth, seeking unity, constancy, and peace. And here this little bug runs around, doesn't have to worry about all that. Already there's a state of unity, constancy, and peace. Perhaps the bug is a concelebrant in this holy act. So last Sunday, as I was putting together the sermon, I found myself almost sounding like Robert Burns, you know, to a louse or to a mouse or something like that, kind of lifting up with real appreciation this living reminder about the pomposity by which we've institutionalized and structuralized the simplest of things, being associated with how we get back into the universal flow, how we rejoin creation, remove the blockages, knock down the obstructions that keep us away from the peaceful harmony by which we get on with it in the creation. The creation isn't finished yet. We're partners in the creation. Now, it's that process that when I, you know, it's like you in the hallway. I was really flipping out in the most sophisticated religious way, I think, getting back in. Now, I was sure when I was preaching about Jesus in the wilderness that that must have been what was happening to him. 40 days or however long it must have been out there in the wilderness, he must have concentrated an awful long time on a rock or a bug or something else, and all those questions got processed through, by which he was then able to say, no, I am not interested in those things which I can grasp, in those things by which I can show forth accomplishment, by which the society or the culture or the power structures of the world are operating. I'm into this other kind of kingdom. And he kept reiterating that, as I understand the Gospels, the kingdom which is already breaking in one's own life, with which one is already linked, if one can discover that. Now, whenever you get a little inkling of that, or a little intimation of that, who said intimation of immortality? One of the great philosophers. There's where the grace, the joy of grace, the ecstatic, the blissful, and so forth, hits me. So, sorry for the long thing, but I thought that was appropriate.
But I think that's really the kind of problem, namely the focus on what the sources of immortality are, that certainly hang up a lot of people that we all know. That the sense of immortality is really a transcendent reality. It's not palpable in the sense of it being sensate. The degrees next to your name, the money in your bank account, the material objects that you have, though I don't minimize their importance, are by their very nature short-term, incomplete, and hardly harbingers of one's immortality. I sometimes find that the more affluent people become, the more the potential is for them to recognize the limits of affluence and get catapulted into the search for the transcendent. And that kind of salvation is really where the making peace within oneself about one's finitude and seeing imperfection as a gift of God rather than a slap from God, and that we have a period of time in which to make a little more perfection of imperfection. Boy, that's a hell of a trip, and after that we're ready to go. And then someone else has to pick up and come after us.
We all have to make big decisions every day and small decisions about how we're going to live our life and what kind of person we're going to be and what we're going to value and what's going to be inconsequential. And to what extent do you think that like your religion can give you guidelines to follow for like what living the good life is, what a good life is, what a good person is? There are, on the most superficial level, there are rules and regulations within most religions, stipulations about what one should and what one shouldn't do. How literally do you take these things? What are they in your religion, and how literally do you read them and follow them?
Well, the literalness that I take out of the tradition is not forgetting to continue to ask the question, what's right, what's wrong, what's important in life, what's not important in life, and the answers to those questions have changed within the history of Judaism, except where it revolves around the sanctity of human life, the dignity of human experience and human beings. But those are, to me, the basic issue within Judaism is to never forget the questions. Many people would key in on the specific answers, but for me, anytime you deal with an answer, you're dealing with an underlying question. So never forgetting the human sensibilities that come from asking questions about humanity is the core that I take out of the tradition continuously.
Yeah, the good life is not a material reference point at all. I just got a mailing from MasterCard. That's now the new name. MasterCharge is changing its name to MasterCard, and they give us a blurb that this is now ensuring the good life. They've got a new logo with the good life being kind of enshrined in this little
secular
box.
Theology. Yeah.
And in fact, it's called the Doorway to Universal Transactions. And they give us a list of 140 plus countries in which it can be used, the first one of which is Afghanistan, you see.
Right.
And it's
and God is the ultimate bookkeeper.
I suppose it's a priceless statement about that concept, the American dream, which is synonymous with a good life, higher education, which is the credentialing process by which one qualifies for entry point into that good life, all being construed as material. Hmm. Even reputation, even the intangibles are materialized. The non-material things are made into graspable packages, self-image, importance, status, all that kind of stuff. Has nothing at all to do with my notion of what the good life is. Neither do rules or do's and don'ts, like Mayer said, except insofar as I violate myself and violate a fellow creature.
Yeah.
Those are central. Out of the tradition, those we keep coming back. As we rediscover the tradition, we keep coming back to that essential thrust that the created order is intended intrinsically to be creative, and that we are a part of a creative process. Therefore, we have intentionality in us that we should thrive in creativity. That which I do to myself or to another member of the creation, which is destructive and violates that integrity of that other entity, is a no-no. So I base my sense of ethics and morality on those simple starting points.
Do you have any sense of what I guess in Buddhism is called karma? You know, that somehow through your actions you're not destiny, but that if you do things well in life, you'll probably lead a good life. And if you're, tell me if I'm misinterpreting this.
I don't know it well enough. So
okay,
you...
but. Well, let me leave out the word karma.
No,
do injustice to that. Mm-hmm. But do you have a sense of, that if you lead a righteous life, that good things will happen to you, and if you do bad things to other people, that somehow you'll be punished, and that it all comes back to you, or you get
the only thing
give,
that I can't agree with in your statement is I'll be punished. I make my bed and I sleep in it. I'm really responsible for myself and what happens to me. My accountability is here. If I sow some bad stuff and it comes back to me, which I do think it probably will sooner or later, then I have no one to complain to. I can't blame it on anyone else. Now, but that's not someone punishing me. I've laid it all out for myself. But I don't like fitting it too closely into cause and effect. Because things go awry. Good people get punished by other people and so forth. So there's no predictability. There's really no predictability.
I don't ask for justice in my behaving well, therefore everything should go well for me. My concern simply is to be the best I can be, which is ever-changing, and that's a process. Be the best I can be for others in terms of the principle of thou shalt not violate. And then the rest that happens is going to happen. What you just identified is really a very pervasive and very childlike notion That is that if you do the right, you'll get back rewarded, and if you don't do the right, you're going to get punished. I imagine that a significant, because it is so primitive and infantile, and I say neither of those negatively, descriptively, right. Not judgmentally, it is in fact basically a myth system with which most adults operate. Well, that somehow or other God is either Big Daddy or Big Zapper, and that's going to really depend upon how you lived your life. When I used to visit schools and talk about life after death, that was one of the questions asked, and I said I did not believe in life after death. A lot of kids would say to me, why be good? And the issue was, well, why can't being good be an end in of itself? Why does it have to be hinged onto a reward? But I think that most people operate with that kind of notion, that if I'm going to be good, everything good better be forthcoming. For me, being good is what I want to do, and if I get zapped, that has nothing to do with my being good.
I think that it has worked its way into many insidious manifestations in the social order. The way that the poor are dealt with, for example, consistently has in it that very element, well, they must have done something to deserve that. The way minorities, I mean, how can you blame a black person for being a black person? However, locked into a ghetto with 40% unemployment and so forth, well, there must be something there. If that person were really good, he or she could work his or her way out of that. That is, there's an insidious involvement with that mentality into destructive results. Mm-hmm. And I just think that we have to find many, many alternatives and encounter that mentality all the way along the line. It also works on the personal level and instills great guilt, which becomes very destructive. People who feel that they ought to be better, whose mother or father was a punishment, a source of punishment, early on instilling into them the idea that I'm bad and cannot accept myself as is or ought to be better in order to be acceptable to anyone else. Therefore, I have all this bad stuff happening to me. I've got it coming to me. And it just kind of like has a ripple effect of more negativity. I mean, so it operates on so many different levels, and its seeds are all the way back.
So there's got to be ways, you think, of teaching goodness or justice without tying it into a reward or punishment, that it's got to transcend that, go beyond that.
Paul Tillich, one of my great heroes, had the main phrase about this, that we are accepted, that is, in the universal sense. The challenge now is to accept the fact that we are accepted, putting it into that framework.
And then translating that into acceptance to everybody else and wherever they are.
We being the whole race.
Yes. Yeah.
As well as one's individual self.
I just want to reintroduce both of you for our listeners who are just joining us. We're talking about some religious concepts and various principles. I have two guests with me who I keep re-inviting back to Fresh Air to talk about these things. With me is Reverend Ralph Moore, who's the director of the Christian Association. He's a priest in the Episcopal faith. And Rabbi Meir Seligman, who is the rabbi with Temple Shalom in Broomall, which is a Reformed temple. They're both friends, and they like to get together and to talk about these kinds of things. And I, myself, like to be around when I can to hear them talk, so I have them come to Fresh Air, and I think it's really interesting to share these things. I want to get to, Mayor, one of the things you were talking about, and that is afterlife. You know, do you believe in life after death? But before that, maybe we should talk a little bit about death itself. One of the most asked questions by everybody, but probably particularly of children, is, my God, if there is a God, why am I going to die? Why did my friend just die? Why is my parent dying? Why is there death? Well, I know we can't answer that question here this afternoon, but how do you resolve that? Or what questions do you ask yourself when that question presents itself to you?
Well, usually when the question is asked, it's because a person is in extremis. And what the person is then asking for is a hand or an arm or a shoulder, and they're not asking for words. The separate issue is to get people to talk about an afterlife and justice and their finitude when they are not confronted with that kind of a situation. Within the structure of the Jewish tradition, you have a number of different answers. You don't have a concept of otherworldly salvation in our Bible. You have some vague notions about an afterlife, but not as a specific reward. With the emergence of the Pharisees around the middle of the second century, they introduce into Judaism a framework of belief which says God so loved his people that, and the people was not specified Jew, his people, that he gave them two laws. And any person who chooses to fulfill those two laws will be rewarded with immortal life, soul will live on forever, and when God establishes his kingdom on earth, bodily resurrection, where the soul and the body will be reunited, and the individual will live again in God's time, not in human historic time. So that is a very powerful concept of salvation, which began with the Pharisees, and which obtains today within Orthodox and Conservative Judaism. Reform Judaism affirms the immortality of the soul, if one could say that Reform has a dogma, but not bodily resurrection. The power of that, the power of the notion that life does not end with death, I stand in awe of. As a matter of fact, I get weak in the knees. I don't affirm that for myself. I don't believe in the immortality. I don't believe in the soul. I don't believe in a life after death. I don't believe in a resurrection. But what it has made me think about is the question. And that is, what is there after life stops? What do I need to do as a person to give myself an answer to my need for immortality when I don't believe in any of the traditional concepts of immortality? And that's what has made me, one, immensely appreciative of that truth for people who still affirm it, but secondly, needs me to find a truth which is good for me, and that is, again, using the word, to know my soul, to know who I am before I die, because I know I ain't going to know it after I'm gone, and then to share my life with others so that they can feed back to me how they see me, so they can help me know myself mm-hmm. better. So that by the time my death comes, whenever that is, I have been true to my quest of knowing who I am mm-hmm. and leaving the truth of me as a person as a legacy to those who know me. If I can do that, and I know that every day of my life I've made a commitment to work in that manner, I can die any time, and I'm ready.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said. I want to give give an example out of Christian background. I guess it was 5 years ago now. A girl at the University of Pennsylvania, a graduate student, committed suicide, and she was a member of St. Mary's Church. She was a graduate student in the Annenberg School of Communications. She was a resident of an apartment house in West Philadelphia, and suddenly she committed suicide. And her parents came in from out of state, and I had to make some quick decisions about what to do, because this was such a guilt-producing, overwhelmingly sad burden on every single one of us, because we all just were there and she suddenly had disappeared without many warnings, you know, unless we started to think about what she was like and what she was doing with her life and some of the disappointments, and we could begin to piece back after the whole thing was a little bit distanced from us what some of those situations were. But now what do I do for the funeral? See, I'm in charge. I said to myself, well, if there ever were a time when the symbols that are available to us in the Christian community could work for a positive rejoicing and release us to celebrate the life of this person, now we will know whether they work or not. And so I said, there's nothing to do for me, no modern interpretation or demythologizing or any of that kind of liberal stuff that I would ordinarily try to do under if I'd had a lot of time to think about it. I'm glad I didn't have a lot of time to think about it. The bold symbols. So, the bold symbols in Christianity are where the casket is brought into the entryway of the church. I encircle the casket with a little sprig of water, and I recite words out of the New Testament which remind us of baptism. And I remind ourselves that this woman had been baptized, which has a symbolism of dying. That's a death, and rising to new life in the symbol of the resurrection. This is a reminder of the waters of baptism. And we, you know, marched the body up, said the celebratory things from the Bible, remembered things about her life, and talked about the understanding of being liberated from that veil of tears, pain, wretchedness, destruction, and moved on past that into an acknowledgement of one another's presence and the fact that she had drawn us into each other's lives in a new way, and that we were grateful to her for many of these new discoveries about our own mortality and how we could rejoice in that. Took the body out, put it in the ground. We were all weak-kneed and nervous, and yet as we were going through that stuff, it objectified and lifted us off, and by golly, it worked. Now, it didn't work in any mechanistic way. It worked in a very profound, aesthetic, poetic way. I have nothing to say about the literalness of bodily resurrection. I have not experienced it. I've experienced, however, the sense of not fearing death, which is much more important to me than to debate forever whether or not this body is going to rise out of the ground. I really don't have any intellectual belief in that. But I've experienced what you might call the freedom of death in these kinds of experiences, which then make it moot. They rob death of any power over me.
You know what made I just thought about when you're talking about it? In a sense, resurrection is the affirmation that the universe is creative, that there is in fact a principle of life, and whether one's individual life is terminated or not, or whether, if we should, God forbid, the human species would be terminated, there is a principle of life which exists in the universe. I could be comfortable with resurrection as being an attempt to grasp at the immortality of the principle of life in the universe. That I could be very comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
I could be very comfortable with the notion of resurrection being a time-limited concept that was really trying to key into that.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole affirmation of the universe being alive and creative because God is alive and creative.
That's the way I have experienced it.
Yeah.
Now, it should come as no surprise to anybody that we are all going to die. So to ask why is like to ask why about gravity, or why about the sun, or why about anything that is of the physical universe. We are all going to die. Therefore, when someone says, why did that person die, unless it's a terribly painful situation, I might say, well, because he or she was hit by an automobile, or he or she had cancer. Look at the facts. There is death in all of us. Some of us die differently. We all die differently. The prior question, and the most important one, is how do I choose my life in such a way so that I choose also my death? So that any given moment that I am alive, I am ready to say that my life is completed. Now, wow, that's a big order, but it's much more exciting to spend one's energies on that question, which has possibility of exploration and joining with others in community exploring, than to then try and assign meanings which really don't exist to cause and effect descriptions of why this or that or the other person happened. Look at the atrocities that people in human history have visited upon each other. And then they come out and say, why did God let this happen? It just is not asking the right set of questions.
So you're like reversing it, because people say, well, how can my life have meaning when I know I'm going to die? And you're saying, well, use death to help give your life the meaning that you want it to have.
See, I think, although I agree in part that the questions sometimes are unanswerable, I think it's in the nature of the human spirit to ask the questions.
Yes,
and
it's
in that process that when one recognizes one's finitude, It does not cast a pall over the rest of one's life. It really has a way of accentuating, heightening, and enlightening the remainder of one's lifetime. Yeah. It's a question of whether you're essentially morbid or whether you turn the real questions into a springboard for renewed life.
Well, there you put your finger on it when you said essentially morbid. See, I've had a long-standing argument with the culture in which we live on that one, because essentially I think it's a morbid culture, the way it tries to disguise and ignore and neglect and deny the fact of death,
yeah.
The way we've isolated the death experience by institutionalizing it, codifying it, categorizing it, so that people have no chance to experience the illness or death of a loved one even, or be around the body to honor it in such a natural way. We've just separated ourselves from the death reality so that we're frightened of it.
And in fact, the society has created a set of rituals, contrary to some of the rituals that are within our own faiths, that would have had a very different attitude toward the death process and to being there when the person died, and to have that reality integrated into one's life's process rather than it being something distant, removed, and fearful.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Ralph, what does your faith tell you about the proper way to set about the mourning process, what to do when someone's died? What are the rituals involved there?
Well, we've lost track of the basic rituals. We just have the church ones now, and they are not adequate. We've consigned over the basic rituals to mortuaries, and I'm really sad about that, and we've got an awful lot of work to do. In the ideal situation, when someone has died, the neighbors, the community people, in this case, let's say in a neighborhood such as a city neighborhood, the people of the community of faith instantly are the first ones there with the people, with the body. There are prayers that can be said, there are thanksgivings, there's an acceptance of the fact that this person has been taken from us. Then the processing of the body, if there isn't a lot of forethought, can be a creative experience. If the person has talked about it, or if there's been discussion in the community about what should happen to the remains, I think Judaism has a lot better understanding of those things than Christianity, which has been so acculturated now that we've lost the distinctiveness of it. But I have seen it happen even in city communities of faith, where the funeral director really has only one small role to play along in the process, and that the church folk and the neighbors and the friends can really dictate it all the way through and get the body celebrated, and if it's going to be cremated or dispersed or given to science or whatever those kind of creative possibilities are. They've been known about and already understood well beforehand, and then there are grief periods. We do feel sad, and especially if it's a person who's died in some ugly circumstances and so forth. We have to rant and rail and feel angry about that. There's nothing wrong with feeling angry and sad and distraught. That's part of love when one is tied to someone closely. There are prayers. There are times in the way we order our lives during those days where we accommodate that process. It's proper to take off a few days and work at that. But the key to it all finally is a celebration. That there's joy for the gift of the one who has been with us and what we've received, and let us go on out and finish the work that this person has given us, you know, finish the model that this person has been working on. I don't think it's as neat. I think it really has been it has been so washed away in our culture, the dominant Christian culture, that these fragments are only being picked up now by some creative church or parish communities, or sometimes not even in churches, but there are people around who are experimenting with building their own coffins and finding other ways of community celebration of the dead. But I think that Judaism has had a better understanding of that process. My notion is, at least.
Last night when I was saying goodnight to my youngest son, he said to me that they were talking about something in school and about some people or things that had died, and he remembered that his grandmother had died about a year ago, and he started to cry. And he put his head down and did not continue talking. And he was talking to me about that last night, and his eyes were welling up, and he was tearful. And I said, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
I said, that really tells you how powerful love is. And he said, did you feel embarrassed because of what the people would say or the way they would respond to you? And he said, yes. I said, you gave them a gift.
Right.
You gave them a gift of being a human being who knows that when a loved one dies, the love for the loved one isn't lost. I didn't say it quite like that,
yeah,
but they got the message. I was very proud of him. I said, anytime you think of grandma and the tears come, think of it as beauty, that grandma is still alive for you, and that anyone who is around and who sees your feeling will be touched and be more human as a result of that. There are a lot of traditions tied up with the death process within Judaism. For example, the Shiva period, that immediately after birth, an individual goes into the technical mourning period of 7 days.
You said after birth, you mean after
death? I'm sorry, after death.
Well, they're interchangeable.
It's a good slip. It's a good slip. And that is the period of most intense mourning. Following the and there one is not to be concerned about one's appearance. One is not to be concerned about greeting people, and all the social graces are no longer required of the mourner. The mourner must not do anything to make his mourning easy. Traditionally, the mourner is to sit on a small stool and to feel discomfort. The idea being, don't make your grief process easy. Then there's after the seven, there's another 23 days called Shloshim, which is the Hebrew word for 30, within which you begin to pick the pieces of your life together so that after the 30 days, you then resume a full range of activity. But the Kaddish, a hymn of praise, a doxology to God, is traditionally recited for 11 months, and in Orthodox and conservative circles, 3 times a day, and in other circles, as often as one would want to and not necessarily tied up in a formal service, as a way of remembering the deceased. But there, it's not so much the remembering of the deceased, it's an affirmation of God. Praised, great, fantastic, hallelujah is God. That's, you know, it's a rough translation of the Kaddish. And it is an affirmation of life, and it's an affirmation of God's wisdom. Again, in relationship to your question, how does one deal with death if it comes from God and God is good? You deal with it by affirming that God is good and that death is good.
I've always wondered about this almost enforced period of mourning in Judaism. I wondered about at what point it might really be self-destructive for someone going through it. Who might better cope by activity, by doing things that are basically not expected of the mourner? A mourner's not supposed to cook or greet guests or sit in a comfortable chair or do anything, really, except mourn. But, you know, couldn't it be that engaging in normal activities and daily activities would really help somebody assimilate what's happened to them?
I agree with that, Terry. My rule of thumb is this. As a teacher, I provide the range of answers that are within the tradition. But the question underlying those answers is, how can you best mourn in a way that will do honor to the deceased and will help you remember and honor the person who has died? So if you choose to go through the Shiva period, the 7 days, although the tradition, when you read it very closely, says you can do it for an hour and then go back to work. There's a whole, you know, it depends upon how you analyze the tradition and its specifics, not the kind of popularized notions that are given to us. But that's the question that I ask. How do you want to mourn? How do you want to honor the deceased? And you have to make those kinds of decisions. Now, within the framework of Orthodoxy or conservatism, they would say to you the best way to mourn and the best way for you to pay honor to the dead is this way. And there's a powerful truth in that, but I would much prefer allowing the individual to pick which truth is the most powerful for him or her in mourning for the individual. The other thing is, my father has been dead 19 years. I find myself mourning for him in ways that I was unable to mourn for him when he died. And I've shared that with Anne and the kids, and I've said to them, it is absolutely amazing how powerful and deep those feelings go, and how they can erupt and overwhelm you when you least expect it. And you know what I do? There's a traditional prayer thanking God for the gift of life called the Shehecheyanu. When I go through that, that's the prayer that I recite. Mm-hmm. And to know that even though I may not visualize the face of my father in my head, I don't have to. It's imprinted within me.
Many Christians still have prayers for the dead. We in the Episcopal Church, in fact, and I'm sure the Romans and the Lutherans, and I'd say a good many of the Protestants are understanding this in some new ways, have some prayers as a part of the morning service for the dead. And it was a new experience for me when my mother died and then my wife's mother died, both, to actually, on a weekly basis, say their names out loud as a part of our Sunday celebration. And I still do that, and they've been dead 5-6 years, each of them. And we both have said to each other many, many times how that has just moved us into some whole new areas that we never even suspected were possible, in a real appreciation and a real reconciliation, a real reconciliation with them.
The dialogue doesn't stop.
No, that's right. And an awful lot of stuff happens after death. The relationship is never broken.
Right.
I'd like to talk about that reconciliation a little bit, because I think death is also another opportunity for guilt. Because of all those unreconciled things, and particularly if it's someone who you've been very close to and you know that there's things that haven't been said. I mean, you can even start thinking about, should I mourn in the way I most feel like I should mourn, or should I mourn in respect of the person who died the way they would mourn and the way they would want me to mourn in their tradition and in their ethics and in their sense of
I see that all the time, that dilemma.
What kind of advice do you give over that, Nick?
Basically, when they're caught up in the question, how do you want to go? And essentially, if we talk about how they want to go, a pattern unfolds that really does allow both to be resolved, though not completely. See, can't get rid of the guilt, because that's a natural response that a person has after someone you love die. You know, I could have been a better son, I could have been a better daughter, I could have been a better this, I could have, you know, why didn't I do this? Why? That's natural. That's a standard and, an innate grief response. But then moving from there and say, how do you want to honor the deceased, and what will it cost your integrity to honor the deceased? And what will it cost your integrity if you don't want to honor the deceased the way he or she wanted to be? And then out of that, a process emerges. It's not clean, and somewhere down the line, the person may come back to me and say, I really think that I didn't do it right then. And all that says to me is, you want to do it differently now? And I said, do it right now. Do it the way you want to do it right now. But there's no clean solution to that, Terry, and it's within all of us.
It has to do with permission, and we give ourselves that permission.
Yeah.
I mean, I did not kill this person. That's the first thing I have to come to terms with, if it's a person close to me, you know, because I feel guilty about the death, because I didn't finish off some obligations, or because, gosh, you know, it's endless. So I have to give myself permission to not feel guilty. And sometimes I have to ask other people who love me to help me give myself that permission by giving me some objective outside input, reminding me of the fact that, yes, I really am a good enough person to receive such a permission, and so forth. And then once I give myself permission to feel that I'm not guilty, then to go on and say, what do I need? I mean, if I really am linked in love with this person, surely sooner or later I can accommodate the fact that this person would want me what is best for me. What do I need now?
Sometimes
I can get there earlier, or sometimes later. That's a difficult process.
Sometimes you have to give people permission to feel guilty because they don't want to, or they block it. And it's a very important part of the mourning process to feel the guilt and be okay with the guilt and to accept the correctness about feeling guilty, because no one who is human doesn't, however contrived it may be. And sometimes I find I have to just break that barrier down in people and say, you know, it's okay to feel guilty. It's very natural. It's normal. Go with it. Because sometimes if they don't, it comes back, comes back to haunt them later on, and they can't understand why they're feeling so guilty. They have nothing to feel guilty about, and they are just overwhelmed with guilt. And they never make the association that's the guilt because they didn't feel guilty when the person they loved died.
Good point. That's a good. It's very so complicated. The thing is that we sometimes we need to be very much alone, and sometimes we need to be with others.
Yeah.
But in all cases, I think we need to have some kind of community that helps us either be alone or with others. So we shouldn't. The thing to do that is so pressing, I think, for any of us who are in organized communities of faith. Is to work on the affirmation of death as a part of life now while everyone's still alive in order to make this a creative life-giving experience so that if I need aloneness or I need help or I need community, those things can be a part of process. That can be a burst of new energy in life if it's done correctly.
We're setting up a program, a group of people in our congregation who are becoming, in a modern way, a Chevra Kedisha. Chevra Kedisha was a technical term of people who came to prepare the body for burial after the death of a person. That's what you were referring to as the community who take care of the dead. And that essentially is not done by Jews now, but funeral homes do that. But we're creating an updated kind of group that will be there to provide information and support and comfort and solace to the family who, whatever they would want, and this has been a very important process, not only to help others, but to help the people who are in the committee deal with the issue of mortality.
Yes.
Very important.
Right.
Secondly, I'm very, very eager, and this has been shared in the congregation a lot, to have burials from our synagogue. It's no way to take away the appropriate and the good and the sensitive work that funeral directors do, but to bring the death back to the community.
Right.
To bring the death and to bring the family into a community of faithful, into a community of loving and sensitive people, and to bring death back where it belongs, in the real stream of life, and not have it in a hospital, and not have it in a funeral home, or not have it here, there, but bring it back and let's live it together, and let's feel it together.
Right.
We've had a number of funerals from our congregation since I've been there. I feel better. I feel supported by the people who were there. I feel supported by the building that I love, and it makes the process of crying and feeling open and okay and not strange because the place isn't strange.
I have had that exact same feeling. They are highly dramatic, pivotal moments in all of our lives, some of the great moments of celebration with people who've died and been buried out of our parish. Exactly the same way, and we've got a little group like that that might be forming. We haven't done too much more, but I want to even have a neighborhood casket making group. Get some carpenters together, put them together, use them as hope chests, try them out, play with them.
I was once involved with an older man who was deteriorating very rapidly, and he was preparing for his death. And this was a man with great energy and great brilliance, and we got all the way through to, I said, Jacques, we're all the way there, but there's one thing you haven't done yet. And I said, you haven't picked out your coffin. And he was in a wheelchair, so we drove over to the funeral home, and he picked out his coffin, and we did it with a great deal of humor and gusto, which was very much a part of his, and it was complete. So that after that, you know, you're going to have guys who are going to make the coffins for the people.
Sure.
Here was Jacques, who needed to take it that way down in order to feel that now everything was in order and he was ready to go.
Sure. I want to make my own. I want to see if I can do it.
Really?
I'm not a very good carpenter, but I would like to try it.
Now, I've been talking about giving my body to science, and I'm having a great deal of difficulty with Anne and the kids because they don't want me to do that.
I haven't figured all the alternatives out. I really must do this so that if I change my mind, at least I'll be able to change it from one point to another.
Oh, gosh. Well, on that note, I think
we're going to talk about death, and it always brings a lot of cheer.
Back to life. Back to life.
Oh, well, we're going to have to end this discussion here because we're out of time. I really can't thank you both enough for coming today. It was really interesting. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Reverend Ralph Moore, who is... priest in the Episcopalian faith, and he's the director of St. Mary's Church, which is on the University of Pennsylvania.
Christian Association,
which is on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. And with me also has been Rabbi Meir Seligman, who is a rabbi with Temple Shalom, which is in Broomall, and that's a Reformed temple. And if you've heard them before on Fresh Air, I keep re-inviting them back to talk about some of the concerns, some of the religious concerns in their lives. Well, that's it for this afternoon's Fresh Air. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 2 o'clock, I'm going to be joined by David Wallachinsky, who you may also know as David Wallace, son of writer Irving Wallace, and together they did The People's Almanac. And David wrote the Book of Lists with the help of a lot of other people. Well, Son of Book of Lists has just been published. This is Book of Lists 2. So he'll be with us at 2 o'clock tomorrow, and we'll find out all kinds of things like the 10 most frequently run movies on television and other things of similar significance. And then at...
Most expensive coffin.
Yes, that's right. At 2:30 or 2:45, we'll be joined by Steve Carey, who is, I believe, a vice president with Haverford College and the chairman of the American Friends Service Committee. Now, during World War II, he was a conscientious objector. And now that there's the possibility of a reinstatement of registration and possibly the draft, I thought it would be interesting to hear about his experiences as a CO during World War II. So we'll be talking about that tomorrow. At 3:30, Francis Davis will be with us for this week's edition of Interval. I hope you can join us then. Contributing to this afternoon's Fresh Air was Francis Davis. Technical director this afternoon was Joyce Lieberman. The associate producer of Fresh Air is Danny Miller. And my name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. Have a really good evening. This is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia, listener-supported public radio.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
It was just more than I could do. You had to cut those chickens just exactly in a certain angle. To me, it was very dangerous. I cut my hand twice. I didn't cut my hand bad, but you know, it bled quite a bit. But they told me to take my time and go right on working.
Lenny Myrick, she and hundreds of other workers are on strike against the chicken processing plant where they work in Laurel, Mississippi. Tonight on All Things Considered, we look at this bitter labor dispute, where workers say the owner of the plant cares more about chickens than the people who slaughtered them.
Also tonight, much political after the facting on New Hampshire, George Bush loses his momentum.